Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
Wow, welcome. I'm trying to overcome the habit of mumbling and speaking softly. So if you're in the background or having trouble hearing me, just wildly raise your hand and I'll remember to speak up. I prepared a talk on the chant that we did during service. So we have a call of lineage, starting with Buddha, and then they kept track of teacher to student who became a teacher through India. So starting about 500 BC, about 500 AD, a guy named Bodhidharma went to China, where there was already some Buddhism, but he presented the approach he learned in India. I found out we chant this lineage going back through time. There's a debate that most of the people in the lineage are men, but I found out Bodhidharma's teacher was a woman in India. Anyhow, then in China, we kept track of the passing on the teaching until Dogen Zenji was born in Japan in 1200. Started practicing as a monk as a teenager. Wasn't satisfied with what he found in Japan. He took a dangerous boat ride to China. He traveled around there. He found a teacher he could relate to. Studied with him for a while and decided to go back to Japan and present the practice and teaching he learned in China. And what we chanted today was the first half of this essay Dogen wrote. He was a very prolific writer and poet. For a practice that stresses silence, it's amazing how much he wrote. And anyhow, so Phukan Zazenki is translated as universal recommendation for Zazen or universal instruction for Zazen. Has anybody here ever read Dogen's writings? Oh, yeah. Well, they're notoriously difficult. They look like prose. If you ever read them, I recommend seeing it as poetry. We expect prose to make sense. But I'm going to pick out phrases, first phrases of what we chanted this morning to explain. I see this, so I said it's his recommendation for Zazen. This is his marketing essay of why we should meditate. He says, "Need I mention the Buddha who was possessed of inborn knowledge? The influence of his 6 years of upright sitting is notable still. For Bodhidharma's transmission of the mind seal, the fame of his 9 years of wall sitting is celebrated to this day. Since this was the case with the saints of old, how can people of today dispense with negotiation of the way?" So he's saying even the Buddha, Bodhidharma, who must have been very gifted people in a way, they practice meditation. Now technically the 6 years of the Buddha is from when he left the palace to when he achieved enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. I think historically he wasn't practicing Zazen that whole time he was practicing kind of anything he could find, you know, in the Hindu tradition. He practiced many things. He practiced extreme asceticism. He didn't feel he found what he was looking for until he decided to just sit under the Bodhi tree and try to have a direct experience of life. So we believe he was sitting the Zazen that we teach. And I think we reenact on December, first week of December, December 8th, Buddha's Enlightenment Day. We kind of reenact by meditating 7 days in some places that he sat all night, final night, and saw the morning star and woke up. So some Zen centers, they sit all night. Won't go into that. And Bodhidharma, he showed up in China. They showed him to the emperor, and they didn't really hit it off. So it said Bodhidharma went, found a cave where he meditated for 9 years. Eventually people kind of heard about him and practiced with him. But that's the line. His fame of his 9 years of wall sitting is celebrated to this day. I think the cave kind of faced the wall when you meditate. So he's really stressing that meditation is the core of our practice. And from the examples of the ancestors, the argument that if we're interested in waking up, we should meditate. So I was raised Christian, and in Sunday school, they taught us to think, what would Jesus do? You know, what would Jesus do? And I had kind of a weird imagination. So I was like, do you mean I can be like Jesus? I can be like Jesus? Like, oh, no, no. You can't be Jesus. Jesus was God. But I was a little bit confused. Like, you know, you want me to like be like Jesus, but that up to what point, you know? So I thought Buddhism made a lot more sense. In Buddhism, we have role models of Buddha, Dogen, and in Buddhism, I say, you mean I can be like Buddha? Of course. That's what it's all about. Go for it. We all believe we are already Buddha, but I won't get into that so much. Anyhow, in Buddhism, this practice is available to us. Next section he describes, practice. You should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. I'm going to go through that. There's a lot there. He says, cease from intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech. Well, I'm talking, you know, we read. We're definitely doing some intellectual understanding, but you know, I say in meditation and instruction, we stop pursuing words and following after speech. So thoughts come up, that's who humans are. There's a great analogy about our thinking is it's kind of like our other bodily functions, like your digestion is doing stuff, your heart's hopefully circulating, your lungs are breathing. So those are all organs. Your organs are, you know, putting out hormones. The brain is just part of the body that's putting out thoughts. It's just as natural as digestion. But what I tell people in meditation instruction is just take a break from trying to solve. Just let the thoughts come up and let them go. We'll get to. So I'd say a way to do that is just be less interested in your thoughts. So this takes some practice. Once you're meditating and, well, it's actually, you could, football game in Port Collins, you could kind of hear the speaker in the stadium, but I couldn't hear a single word he was saying. It was just the sound. And I thought, well, that's similar to meditation. I'm just like, I know I'm thinking, but I'm not going to entangle myself. I'm not going to try to solve things. But I noticed in my life, the practice, I got certain issues. I'm like trying to meditate. I'm sure if I think about that one more time, I'll solve it. But then my life's just kind of like this merry-go-round, you know. It just doesn't. So far, my thinking hasn't solved that much. So you just kind of let the merry-go-round. But back when computers, I don't know what computers do now. I used to have these hard drives that were just constantly spinning. So that's kind of like our mind. We just let the hard drive spin, but we're not going to like get the data off of it. My teacher, Katagiri Rushi, had a saying about meditation. He says, rest your frontal lobe. So they know from studying the brain, your analytical problem-solving thinking is in the frontal lobe. So we just let it rest to the extent we can. And you've got, your brain's doing all sorts of other, the rest of your brain's doing amazing stuff. And we just let our whole brain just function naturally. But I was going to say, it's not like a lobotomy. It's not like you're trying to destroy anything, or it's just take a rest. Sometimes I compare meditation to a sleep. It's very, can be very refreshing and energizing. You're just resting the frontal lobe. And here's how Dogen says it. He says, learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. So I'd say humans were pretty externally oriented, and that makes sense because we need to be in tune with the culture because the culture supports us. It's how we survive. We survive because of other people, biologically. But I say, you know, we know what the problem is with the world. The problem is these other people. And these other people, they're just doing everything wrong. They're thinking the wrong things. It's all messed up because of these other people. And what are we going to do? We're going to change them? We're going to get rid of them? We're going to ignore them? But I don't know. It's all intense, but that's a forward step. Yeah, it's other people, but Toby says learn the backward step. to illuminate yourself. Sometimes the type of meditation we do is Chinese Zen, they call it silent illumination. You sit in silence and just by letting your subconscious go through this organic process of whatever comes up when you're meditating, we really trust whatever comes up, but we don't pursue it intellectually. I heard a Tibetan teacher, he said in Tibet, the word for Buddhist means an internalist, someone interested in their internal state. And one thing I'll say is, if we want things to change, we might have a little more luck working with ourselves than trying to get other people to change. And then I explained, so meditation is really getting to know yourself, be friends with yourself, be intimate with yourself. And you might say, but this is all just too self-absorbed. I worked for this nonprofit, social activist nonprofit, and one of the guys said, I certainly don't do navel gazing. That was his sense that meditation's too inwardly focused, but I came across an interesting point. If you understand how your mind works, what you're going through, there's a very good chance other people's minds work similarly and are going through similar things. So if you understand what you're going through, you can actually maybe have a little more clue of what our fellow humans are going through and maybe be a little helpful. Okay, body and mind of themselves will drop away. But really? So, when thoughts are coming up, they drop away because otherwise you couldn't have a new thought. So, you know, we get obsessed with things. We think we have patterns of thinking. I told one Zen teacher, I said, you know, I keep having the same thoughts over and over. He goes, oh, you never have the same thoughts. Every moment you're having this, it's always new. It's like, but it seems the same. But very quickly, so we're aware, I'm having a thought, it came up. And we're like clinging to it, getting involved with it. But without doing anything, thoughts naturally drop away. Another thought comes up, but it's naturally dropping away. So this, and same with bodily sensations like, oh, this is intense, but it changes. It changes. Sometimes we hope sooner than later, but it changes. So it sounds mysterious, but it's kind of explaining what already happens. Okay, then there's something, your original face will be manifest. So this goes back to it was a Zen koan. Oh, what's your original face before your parents were born? Okay, this makes sense. I was doing this kind of koan study with one teacher is during the pandemic, so we have masks on. She goes, what's your original face before your parents were born? I just took off my mask. That wasn't the answer, but it's close to an answer. Answers are always have to do with present state of moment. And then we're interested. I mean, to me, this makes logical sense, but there's the world as it exists in the moment, and we're thinking. So we make sense of the world, like, oh, what's happening is figuring out what's happening because I have these thoughts. But the world is fully, completely happening, connected to the past, connected to the future. It's happening before you start thinking. So in Zen, that's a backward step. We're interested in what is the world like before my habitual stream of thoughts is trying to interpret. It has to exist. It already exists, whether we think or not. So that's kind of your original face, and we're connected to the past. We're connected to all the generations going back, not just our parents. So this, what's this reality that's always present? Before we start describing our parents and describing our personality and this sense of reality just blooming across time without describing it with thoughts. Because if you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. I saw this amazing bumper sticker a while ago that I would rather be here now. So we're already always here now. We just aren't that awake to it. I'm not that awake to our immediate experience. It's called mindfulness. So we're interested in waking up to our immediate experience. And part of that waking up, or we call it oneness, interconnectedness. So Zen kind of explains there's two views. The normal view is everything's separate. That's a good view. We can figure stuff out and we can say, that's my toothbrush. That's not your toothbrush. Everything separate is how we've developed this amazing, comfortable human culture. It's great, but it has what I call a side effect, which I might just call neurosis. When I'm separate from everything, wow, that's kind of scary. That's kind of and so Buddhism we teach we call oneness. So mindfulness, you're interested in just being with what's present, 100%. You just future, you're still connected to the future and past, but we're interested in. So sometimes it's said like rock climbing. Boy, I don't like NASCAR racing, but they must be 100% aware. So oneness, and then so being aware is very brief. Sometimes I think. So we say we practice mindfulness, well, say all the time, but let's say you're cooking. So you're cutting carrots and you're like, oh, these carrots are really orange. I mean, it's impressive. It's impressive how orange these carrots are. And I'm aware and I'm like, wow, I'm succeeding. I'm practicing mindfulness. Well, right there, you're kind of drifting away. So it's all very quick. But when you do, We have this word suchness or thusness. I'm thinking it's just kind of same as oneness, but it's almost like the taste. So suchness, not kind of compare it to sunrise or sunset, you know, and the earth takes on this little glow from the sun. It's like you're really like, wow, I appreciate how wonderful. How wonderful things are, how wonderful the moment is. It suddenly reality seems to be imbued with being kind of special, enjoyable, precious, maybe being a say holy. So that's kind of the use of suchness, very much connected to this. You of oneness. Okay, one last section here. Got two parts. Part once. You have adjusted your posture. Take a deep breath. Inhale and exhale. Rock your body right and left and settle to a steady, immobile sitting position. So I explained Zazen instruction. A lot of Zen centers don't do this anymore, but Katagiri Roshi, after you sit down and adjust your posture, put your hands on your knees. And well, at the beginning, you breathe out as you stretch all the way one way. Breathe in slowly, stretch the other way. So you're taking some time to settle, and we do that. Well, we don't actually count. I do count. See my people do what I don't. What's it? Who knows? 5 times each way. Anyhow, they're lessening circles, swings. So you're kind of like a pendulum. You've settled yourself. So got a sense of being upright. And then at the end, we do it slow, smaller circles to bigger, and stretching feels very good. Then we settle into sitting relatively still. I say, it's pointed out to me, you're never sitting, you're not a stone, you're never sitting still because pay attention to your breath, your shoulders rise, chest and belly expand, your blood circulating. So it's not actually stillness, but it's and then as the body settles, that really helps the mind settle too. Oh, but when that swaying side to side, we were all sit pretty close to each other, so you had to be careful you weren't swaying to the right while the other person was swaying to the left and banging your head together. So just another chance to be aware of what's going on around you. So this line is may not make sense, but I think I'm going to explain it, because how do you think of not thinking? And he says, non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. Well, what the heck? What's the difference between not thinking and non-thinking? But first I'll say, well, you know, I know I'm sitting there and thoughts are going. I'm just curious. Well, how? What would not thinking be like? Curious. So to me, I think when we say not thinking, it sounds like a corrective, like, oh my gosh, I'm thinking, I'm not supposed to be thinking. How do I not think? But already then we're just producing more thinking, more thinking about not thinking. And that's a tricky part during meditation. I tell people at the beginning of meditation instruction, thinking's okay. Thinking's okay, it's natural. I said digestion, but just be present. At the end, I say, how'd it go? They said, oh, well, I was thinking too much. I'm like, I just told you not to criticize yourself about thinking, to just accept your thinking. Anyhow, here's what occurs to me. To say not thinking, it's a little bit like saying, don't think of a pink elephant. So good luck with that. You know, you're already thinking of a pink elephant. So here's the difference. Non-thinking already exists. Before you think, while you think, and after you think. Non-thinking is a natural condition which includes thinking. Yeah. And we don't believe that. Dogen has another phrase, pay attention to the sound of the bell, the issues before and after the striking of the hammer. So we're like, well, that sound came from the hammer hitting the bell, but the bell already exists, the hammer already exists, the potential, it's connected to the past, it's connect the sound. So we focus on a state of mind where, it's all connected. So we're already have non-thinking, and then these ephemeral, totally ephemeral thoughts that are probably not as consequential as we think they are in the moment, kind of like smoke arising. It's just changing, but the whole world is already there, besides just the ephemeral thoughts coming up. That's my thought. So I was told, I hope you have questions about anything.
Is there a breathing pattern that you use? Breathe in, hold, breathe out, hold, anything like that?
I believe those breathing patterns can be very helpful, but no. Just breathe naturally. But I will say one thing, is your breathing, well, Buddha said, let a short breath be a short breath, let a long breath be a long breath. So occasionally, like I said, you feel your abdomen. Sometimes your attention can really be down. This movement in our body as we breathe, the biggest movement is actually down in our abdomen, because the organs have to move out of the way for the lungs to expand. So it feels like you're breathing all the way down to your belly button, and we hold our hands down there. It's a wonderful experience if you can really be present. You know, that's the area that's your center of gravity. Like if you're doing a tightrope, you're right there. And it's also another major nerve center. The brain's a major nerve center, your gut. And I met Copencino, who started this center, and he had us all lie down and just try to really get in touch with breathing deeply. But then, so that's one technique, say, breathe deeply, but then you start getting critical, like, oh, I'm not breathing deeply enough, blah, blah, blah. We stop being critical, so we accept whatever our breathing is. So, but we also have moments of being aware of what our breathing is.
In my view, the ultimate goal of zazen. And so, what does it feel like? How does it feel like?
Yes, it's enlightenment, the ultimate goal.
Yep.
So I heard one teacher recently, he thinks we should use the word awakening instead of the word enlightenment. But don't use the word enlightenment. So we believe it's already happened. And it's not. Well, Dogen gives the example of what we chanted this morning about somebody who had an enlightenment experience and then they think they're hot stuff, which is kind of the opposite of enlightenment. So we just kind of just keep practicing being present. And you can have a sense some people are more present than others, and sometimes have a sense you're more present. But then once again, yeah, as we get older, we're like, our mind just starts to deteriorate. And it's not, enlightenment's kind of almost a dangerous concept. It's like, oh, that's something far away, I'll never get there. It's like, oh, it's already right here. I call this the journey to here. If I'm on a spiritual journey, I practice stepping further every day. Well, you're just trying to get where you are. And sure, you can have, when you're present, it's often you feel grounded, peaceful, joy, bliss, sometimes use, but it's not about those results. If you're sick, you know, your heart's broken with no heart. Yeah, it's not, not balloons and roses, it's just whatever things are. Yeah.
Did you talk about meaning of the word way in the Zazen tradition?
Yeah, then they say ways could be related to the Tao. So I think it has a couple meanings. One is the way things are. But there is a sense that we're following, well, so meditating is a way to be in the present. So if we some kind of consistent meditation, we say we're following a way. So those are different meanings. Another meaning is, and meditating's hard. I only taught meditating as a Buddhist thing. We like, first you bow and people looked at me in horror. Like, I didn't come here to It's that there's a reason I'm not a Catholic anymore. It's like they didn't come here to bow, they came here to learn how to meditate. So I tried, I had a meditation studio where I teach secular meditation and then Zen Buddhism, Republic, and then did two different things. I thought maybe secular meditation would be popular on all this bowing stuff. But I kind of found, now people do not like to sit in silence. So having a tradition that comes from the past and people current, having a sense, it's all supportive of meditation. It's supportive of waking up. So that's another meaning of the word way.
Question. So, can you share some advice on how to practice meditation more often? Sometimes I found I don't have the self-discipline to do so, let's say, not even daily, but just you know, this is so good for you, but I find it hard to keep doing it. If you can share some advice.
Yeah, somebody could actually know the answer to why all these healthy things that are so good for us that we don't do, like exercise or diet. So one technique is at home, set up a space for it that's maybe noticeable. And then just kind of realistically look your schedule, like when would be a good time for me to meditate? Some people do it early in the morning before everything gets going and so busy, but other people aren't morning people. So you can experiment. What might work for me? You can study. The important of Buddhism is convincing us it's good to meditate. I get a little cynical. I'm like, you can spend $100 on a meditation cushion and then, you know, is it? I find, so some people find sitting with other people. And so there's a, any local Buddhist group has a schedule. And yeah, it gives you a focus. I'm going to go there at the right time and sit with these people, which I find supporting. I lived next door to this one Zen center. Not many people came to sit, but I'd lie in bed. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I want to go. But then I'm like, if I don't go, Joel's going to be sitting there alone. Mm-hmm. And I like my friend Joel, so I'm going to get him.
Thank you for your talk. That generates a lot of my own thoughts. Maybe let's see. Sense of responsibility. Roads. I've heard
responsibility and what?
Pros.
Pros.
He's mentioned pros in the beginning.
Yeah.
Been indoctrinated by pros. Going to school, lawyers, writers, and then I heard a guiding teacher here, the Buddha didn't speak in prose, which was good to hear, because it is a language that is not of my own.
Mm.
forced to be able to use it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you talked about, which I think was, I'm not good in my hearing, so I invent things that are sometimes more creative than actually what was said.
Okay.
But I think you were talking about cutting carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said, oh, I'm cutting carrots, but at that moment is when I drift away. Was that right?
The moment when I notice, I'm more mindful than I normally
am. Okay. I misunderstood.
And then I very subtly, oh, good boy, good boy. I'm practicing mindfulness. That's when you slip away.
That's when you drift away.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Very good. I really enjoyed that a lot. So also, I guess I needed to mention this thing that's always said, especially I think with prose, which I'm learning more about, it has a tendency to juxtapose. And one of the things that's said here is not to. So this again points for me to prose. The other thing that I think for me personally that I felt raising my children, being a school teacher of young children, they are totally absorbed by looking at me. And if I ask them, like my children, they're just waiting for me to have it be over with, whatever it is I'm saying. The best I could come to was after is by example.
Mm-hmm.
I just live by example.
Yeah.
And my son, now 35, he resonates some of this, what I just did, what I lived.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I speak, which I see speech is the exhale in this practice or focus. Mm-hmm. It's one part is in our breath. There's an inhale. It's not only exhale. Almost all languages exhale. So anyway, this coming back to the carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel one of the awarenesses of what happens here is this audience of workers. It isn't a monastery. It is always an audience, for the most part, like myself, of workers. And the most essential part to me of this being here and why it is to bring this into, as they say, into your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
What you explained of cutting carrots to me, nailed that right on the head. So I thought maybe
a letter, yes. Speech is an exhale. Thought occurred to me, ears are inhale. So one advantage of mindfulness is to encourage us to listen. So often when other people are talking, we're like, oh yeah, but here's what I'm going to say, here's what I think. And we're not listening very carefully. So the focus of mindfulness is to look at other people when they speak. You can get a lot of information from looking at them and listening and considering what they're saying. That's our day, that's inhale. And then we have a good, hopefully, a nice exhale as we express ourselves. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say this, but sometimes men have a problem not listening. Mm-hmm.
A little more of them. I'm sure women don't listen to them. I have to say, men should try to listen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.